So now I'm an influencer, apparently. At least according to the latest spam email I've received, influencers like me can make money from our posts, so it claims. I've no idea who I might be influencing with my posts on my blog or my stories on the Sleaze or even the podcasts I do here for the Overnightscape Underground. But I can allegedly get paid for them. Influencer is just one of those terms I hate. As far as I can see, it is simply synonymous with someone who has a YouTube channel and delusions of grandeur. Believe me, just because you can get people to look at it doesn't actually mean that you are some kind of celebrity, talented, or even influence people. Certainly no more than I am, just because I run a couple of websites. The most hilarious part of the spam email is where it talks about growing your traffic. This at a time where traffic seems to be in terminal decline for most of the web, thanks mainly to Google's blatant abuse of its new monopoly of web searches. Which, of course, is what the email is all about. Clearly, the service behind it is finding that monetization of their existing customers is yielding lower returns due to this decline in traffic, and they are now desperate to expand their client list in the hope of increasing returns. Desperate to the extent they're even contacting small fry like me. Obviously, this presupposes that the email is genuine, not some kind of phishing scam, although the email address isn't spoofed and the links it contains seem to genuinely point towards the site in question. Maybe they know something about the reach and influence of my posts and stories that I don't. Maybe I'm more influential than I think. After all, I'm now listed on the Internet Movie Database, IMDb. For some reason, an Overnightscape Central that I participated in currently has an entry there, listing Doc Sleaze as part of the cast. Actually, it isn't the first time I've been on there. One of my film reviews from my blog was once linked to on the relevant movies page as an external review. And in fact, after checking, it actually still is there. it was a Cliff Twemlow movie, which are pretty obscure as far as mainstream audiences are concerned, and for which there tend to be very few reviews. So maybe that's it. I'm very influential with people who listen to underground podcasts and watch ultra-low budget British regional cinema. Which must be a pretty limited audience, meaning the chances of generating an income stream from it is pretty much nil. Which is fine by me. I've never had any desire to make money from the web. The truth is that very few people do, unless they're a multinational like Amazon or Google. Even when they do it best, all they do is generate enough to cover things like hosting costs. The only people likely to make money from schemes like the one the spam email originated from are those running the schemes, because that's what these people really mean when they say they can show you how to make money from the web, that they are going to make money from you on the pretext of doing this.
Well, I discovered Juggling Janet in this dingy little bar. I said, let me be your agent, love. I'll make you a megastar. Well, I got contacts, didn't I? So I got her booked in a place with class. The governor seemed well pleased. And when I took the normal agent's fee, I was laughing all the way to the Leeds. Well, I got me overheads to consider, didn't I? See, I got an account called Liquid Gold. Now, I know that sounds quite funny, but it means the Leeds takes your proceeds and adds on extra money. I was quids in with the Leeds. But then she cries, your fee's too high. It's more than all the others. I said, who told you that, my dear? She said, oh, my little brothers. Nice boys. Gave me a lift to the Leeds. Well, you can get your wedge out instantly if you have an urgent yearning. And even if it's not there long, you know it's still been earning.
Liquid Gold now pays up to 7.75% for bigger savers, so laugh all the way to the Leeds.
Possibly the most unconsciously ironic thing I've noticed online over the past year or so has been people who claim they gave up a normal lifestyle to travel nomadically in a camper van or a boat or whatever in order to go off-grid, then posting videos on YouTube telling us about their new off-grid existence. Because, I mean, I really can't think of anything more on-grid than using the internet, the ultimate information grid, to share your travels on the world's largest videos sharing site. It isn't just the odd video. Most of them seem to have channels to which they regularly churn out content in order to boost the follower count and chase the views. Perhaps they don't really understand what off-grid means. as I understood it, people who did this were trying to escape from modern society and its often excessive connectivity, constant scrutiny by the authorities, and from being tied down and restricted by such things as mortgages and conventional employment. Speaking personally, if I ever decided to go off-grid, I'd pretty much disappear completely from view, abandon stuff like mobile phones and the web, and basically become a hermit. Not that you need to go and live in a caravan in a muddy field in some obscure corner of the country to achieve some degree of withdrawal from society. I do it pretty well from my terraced house. For the next 6 months or so, I've gone out of my way to minimise my social presence. I rarely speak to neighbours or bother keeping up with acquaintances or extended family. I've just kept myself to myself. But then again, perhaps I am misunderstanding the term off-grid. Perhaps they mean something slightly different. Perhaps they mean things like, you know, being off the national power grid, you know, and generating their own power through their solar panels and diesel-powered generators and whatever. I don't know, but it just does seem to me that going online and onto YouTube to tell people about the greatness of your off-grid existence just seems ironic. But getting back to me, I've kept up my web presence. The very fact that I'm recording this attests to that fact. But an online existence is actually easier to manage. You can literally switch off contacts if they get too much and you don't actually have to deal with people face to face. To be honest, I haven't done this in order to go off-grid and evade modern life. With so much having changed in my life over the past couple of years, I just felt the need to drop out for a while and indulge in some mainly solitary contemplation. Besides, I'd enjoyed the various lockdowns so much that I wanted to extend them a bit. But I've started to re-emerge of late, you know. I've resumed meeting a select few friends at the local pub, for instance, a couple of times a month. So, you know, I suppose this has all been a way of resetting my life, putting some distance between myself and the past, those bits associated with my former job mainly. But I certainly haven't been going off-grid, or even claiming to have done so. I certainly haven't been posting YouTube videos about going off-grid, which brings me back to the original point of this post, the on-grid off-gridders, who eschew a conventional lifestyle and things like houses, jobs and other ties. There's always the question of how they finance such lifestyles. Some, obviously, are retired and have pensions. Others have private means. Some have even managed to combine their new lifestyle with some kind of new self-employment based around said lifestyle. There is another group, though, that seems to earn money through what, to me, seems rather opaque, if that's the right word, means. These are the ones who try to turn their entire existence into a business of sorts by putting it all onto social media and YouTube and getting their subscribers to make payments via things like Patreon. It's probably just my age, but this always feels to me uncomfortably like a high-tech form of begging. Okay, I know that actual beggars find themselves due to circumstances in a situation where they have no choice, but to rely on the charity of strangers in order to pull together some loose change, while the sort of on-grid, off-griders I'm thinking of are at least providing some sort of product in exchange for your support. Except that this product or content is simply a cannibalisation of their actual lives. In effect, they are chronicling their alternative lifestyle for public consumption in order to gain the financial means to keep on living this lifestyle, not to mention the technical means to keep on recording it, and serving it up as entertainment for more paying customers. Which just seems somewhat strange to me. Why should I feel the need to pay to watch someone else living their life when I can experience my own for free on a daily basis? Out of curiosity, I recently watched a live stream by one of these on-grid off-gridders, ostensibly intended as an opportunity for fans to interact with them, but I had to switch it off after a few minutes, so uncomfortable did the underlying solicitations for money make me feel. Don't get me wrong. They certainly didn't seem like unpleasant people, but it rather reminded me of those US TV evangelists' televised preaching sessions where the totals of donations from worshippers keep popping up on screen. Like I say, maybe it's my age, but it just doesn't seem a particularly, I don't know, good way to fund your chosen lifestyle. And just for the record, I can fund my current non-working lifestyle as a result of many years of good financial management when I was working, which has left me financially secure for the foreseeable future, and with the prospect of a decent work pension, actually two work pensions, paying out within the next 2 years. So there you go. I don't have to set up a Patreon account.
The nights are darker. And night is when it happens in the Dunwich Horror. Come back, old one. Princes of darkness, and repossess the earth. The Dunwich Horror, based on H.P. Lovecraft's terrifying tale of those who explore the unspeakable. Starring Sandra Dee, Dean Stockwell, Academy Award winner Ed Begley, Sam Jaffe. Believes the history of horrendipity written here. The love story of a girl looking to the future and a boy dedicated to the mysteries of the past. He invokes the unspeakable.
Yeah, Satha.
She invites it.
You're one of us now.
Depthless paradise of terror where fear eternal lives. And the dead come to life.
I've never heard anything like that.
I still maintain that 1970s, the Dunwich Horror, stands as possibly the best attempt to date to commit H.P. Lovecraft to film. I recently rewatched it as my sort of tribute to the late Dean Stockwell, who stars in the film. It represented the culmination of a cycle of Lovecraft adaptations that appeared during the late 60s, mainly produced or co-produced by AIP, who were rapidly running out of Edgar Allan Poe's stories to adapt. Indeed, one of the first of these, 1963's The Haunted Palace, was actually presented as part of the Roger Corman Poe series. But despite the Poe title and the presence of Vincent Price, it was actually a loose adaptation of Lovecraft's The Strange Case of Charles Dexter Ward. There are also no less than three UK-made Lovecraft adaptations, with only The Shuttered Room from 1967 pretending to be set in the US. The others, 1965's Die Monster Die, also known as Monster of Terror, which is based on The Colour Out of Space and featuring a cast headlined by Boris Karloff. And then there was Curse of the Crimson Altar from 1969, which, while not officially a Lovecraft adaptation, does bear a very close resemblance to The Dreams in the Witch House. Both of these latter films are relocated to contemporary, or then contemporary, rural England. So what, in my opinion, makes the Dunwich Horror stand out from these previous adaptations? Well, for one thing, it's a much purer adaptation than any of the others. To be sure, it makes many deviations from the source material. The characterisation of Wilbur Whateley, played by Dean Stockwell, and the addition of a female lead character stroke romantic interest in the form of Sandra Dee, for instance. But it fully embraces the core concepts of Lovecraft's Cthulhu mythos, which underpins the majority of his work. Previous films had tended to soft-pedal this angle, with Haunted Palace and Crimson Altar substituting more generic evil forces, which the makers doubtless felt audiences would more readily understand. Die Monster Die focused on the science fiction monster elements, while Shuttered Room ditched the supernatural elements of its source entirely. But in The Dunwich Horror, Ed Begley Sr.'s Dr. Armitage is quite clear that the Whateley family are part of a cult worshipping ancient entities long since banished from the Earth to other dimensions, but still seeking a re-entry to the human realm. Various of the Lovecraftian deities are name-checked, and the Necronomicon, that dread text of evil, is central to the plot, with Wilbur seeking to accept to possess Armitage's copy in order to invoke his masters. Some of the film's digressions from the source material, however, are quite fascinating and in many ways serve to enhance its theme of shadowy ancient forces attempting to overtake modernity. Most notably, the film, not surprisingly given its date of production, encompasses a fair amount of psychedelic imagery and effects. These are manifested most prominently in the dreams experienced by Dee's character as she's drugged by Whateley and ends up sleeping at the Whateley house, and in the effects employed to represent Wilbur's demonic brother once he escapes from his locked room. Actually, this is impressive on another count, as the producers resisted the temptation to simply have Stockwell in evil makeup or a man in a suit to represent their monster. What we get instead is a truly otherworldly looking creation. It also contrasts sharply with The Shuttered Room, which replaces its monstrous twin with the standard mad sister in the attic. Not only does the psychedelia bring the story firmly into the then-present day, but it also aligns the whole Cthulhu cult with the hippie and drug subculture of the era. This in turn gives a new subtext to the fact that the forces of darkness are here opposed by Dr. Armitage and Dr. Corey, played by Lloyd Bochner, a pair of old men, effectively representing the deep social conservatism of author H.P. Lovecraft. Old men trying to put the genie of youth and revolution back in the bottle, perhaps. Well, they apparently succeed in foiling Wilbur's plans to sacrifice Dee as part of his attempt to open up a portal by which the old ones can return. A brief coda implies that their attempts are futile, as it is revealed to the audience that Dee is now carrying a child, having been impregnated by Wilbur or his demonic brother. This is another deviation from the original, with its implications of sex, something absent from the Lovecraftian canon. Although Freudians might point to all the using substances and flailing tentacles of the original text as sexual proxies. Here, the impregnation of Dee as she lies on the altar stone in the Devil's Hop Yard is heavily implied as Wilbur spreads her legs apart and then props the open Necronomicon between them, indicating that some sort of supernatural impregnation by its ancient sorceries was actually his plan all along. But alongside all this modern psychedelic and sexual imagery, the film also succeeds in creating the sort of stifling atmosphere of the typical Lovecraft story, the feeling that dark forces are inevitably and inexorably closing in. Despite being filmed in sunny California rather than dank and damp New England, the movie succeeds in depicting the sort of isolated community described by Lovecraft, where ancient superstitions and lifestyles have survived into the modern world. The 30s in the story, the late 60s in the film. All of these elements contrast effectively with the modernistic touches, which hint at some kind of wild and frightening world that lies outside of the village's experience. Moreover, while Wilbur certainly isn't as weird as his literary equivalent, who's revealed to himself be monstrous, with tentacles protruding from his abdomen, his seduction of Dee necessitating his transformation to a somewhat more human and personable character, as played by Stockwell, complete with runic tattoos all over his body, he's still pretty creepy. So, a properly Lovecraftian film, which remains true to its roots, providing a stark contrast with previous adaptations that sought to reinterpret their source material via other horror tropes or even other genres. The most radical reinterpretation being The Shuttered Room, the only one of these adaptations without an AIP connection, incidentally, which discards not just its Lovecraftian elements, but also its supernatural elements altogether, substituting instead a cross between a gothic melodrama and a straw dog-style story of small-town hicks menacing outsiders. The latter element, featuring Oliver Reed in a role reminiscent of his character in Hammer's The Damned from 1963, if the psychopathic, not to mention lecherous, leader of the local thugs is the best handled part of the film. But the whole thing feels a long way from Lovecraft, failing even to make Dunwich, here transformed into an isolated island, into a convincing locale. Interestingly, there was a contemporary novelisation of the script which actually reinstates some of the supernatural elements. To be fair, the source story was only peripherally a Lovecraft story, being presented by author August Derleth as a posthumous collaboration based on notes left by Lovecraft. That said, it certainly had Lovecraftian themes, attempting to unify two strands of the Cthulhu mythos, that of the Dunwich Whateleys and that of the Innsmouth spawn of Dagon. The film, however, ignores both of these strands, instead turning it into a standard horror thriller. Former art director Daniel Haller, who had also directed Die Monster Die, directs the Dunwich horror with a sure visual sense, effectively contrasting the sunlit white stone edifices of the Miskatonic University in Arkham with the run-down, more autumnal-looking town of Dunwich, emphasising the idea that they are not just separated by geography, but also by culture and even time. He moves the film along at a decent pace, rarely allowing things to flag as it simultaneously follows the twin plot lines of Wilbur preparing his plans and Armitage unravelling the tangled history of the Whateleys. And in doing so, he manages to open up the Lovecraftian styled narrative of the source material, which, as with most Lovecraft stories, doesn't actually involve a lot of action as such. It involves a lot of people reading books and sitting in libraries or reading old letters and learning about things secondhand. Instead, he puts things firsthand, so to speak. The characters discover things firsthand most of the time, and you as the audience participate in their discovery. But at the same time, Haller's direction, while stylish, has a certain pulp aesthetic to it, particularly in his use of colour, which is fitting, as despite Lovecraft's literary pretensions, his stories were mainly published in pulp magazines like Weird Tales, with their garishly colourful covers. It also features a standout animated title sequence that neatly encompasses many of the film's themes and a highly effective Les Baxter score. Obviously, there have been many subsequent Lovecraft adaptations, but none that I've liked as much as the Dunwich horror. Many have more fidelity to the source material, but most are low budget and scrappily made, mistaking poor lighting for atmosphere. The only one I've really enjoyed was Reanimator, but that is based on an atypical non-mythos Lovecraft story. Ultimately, none achieve the trick of being both respectful to the source material while also successfully reinterpreting it for their own era, as I believe the Dunwich horror does.
They fought for their love in a world haunted by horror.
What was that?
Breath of the living be snuffed out by the hand of darkness? The monster lives in death.
Get out of this room.
Boris Karloff, never before more demoniacal. He takes you beyond the boundaries of shock.
No matter how much of a cinephile you might be, there are always entire genres of films that pass you by, whether they be mainstream, musicals in my case, or exploitation. Nazi exploitation being one exploitation genre, for instance, I've never really been interested in. Sometimes it isn't the subject matter of the genre so much as their availability for viewing which results in this situation. Recently, for instance, I finally experienced an example of a genre that I was aware of, but simply had never had the opportunity to view properly before. Santo in the Blue Demon Against the Monsters from 1970 is, of course, one of those Mexican wrestling movies featuring masked stars of the Mexican ring. These are a very localized phenomena, and while I know that examples are available in the US, they rarely seem to reach the UK market. Certainly few were ever dubbed or even subtitled into English. Anyway, this one, which I caught courtesy of the Otherworlds TV streaming service, is, as its title implies, one of the crossover entries in the genre, which features not one, but two masked stars, Santo and Blue Demon, but also features a horror science fiction plot. Actually, the title is somewhat misleading, as for much of the movie, the two titular grapplers aren't fighting side by side against the monsters. Blue Demon is captured by the bad guys early on, and a fake Blue Demon spends a lot of time trying to frustrate Santo's attempts to defeat the monsters. The plot is straight out of a 30s or 40s movie or serial. A mad scientist that the wrestlers had apparently brought to justice is executed, but then secretly revived by his henchmen. Naturally, the scientist vows revenge against not just Santo and Blue Demon, but also his own brother and niece, who is also Santo's girlfriend, who are instrumental in his downfall. To do this, not only does he plan to use his army of zombies, but also to revive several legendary monsters to assist in his schemes. Obviously, these include a Dracula-type vampire, Frankenstein's monster, some vampire women, and a scrawny-looking mummy, plus a couple of uniquely Mexican monsters, a weird dwarf-like thing with a huge head and exposed brain, and a cyclopean amphibious creature. These were leftover costumes from another classic Mexican movie, Ship of Monsters. What follows is quite insane, with lots of Batman-style action, comic strip wrestling-inspired fights, and car chases. At one point, the monsters all take on Santo in a wrestling ring. In one particularly bizarre moment, Frankenstein's monster, who has facial hair in this film, drives the getaway car after he and the other monsters kidnap the niece, chased by Santo in his sports car. Equally bizarre is the fact that neither of the wrestlers ever take their masks off, not even when Santo is romancing his girlfriend, which all seems a bit creepy. Obviously, a lot of the apparent weirdness is the result of English-speaking audiences' unfamiliarity with various aspects of Mexican popular culture. Many Mexican films from the 50s and 60s look decidedly off-kilter to English-speaking audiences, but were clearly not considered so in the country of origin. Not surprisingly, Santo and Blue Demon against the monsters looks incredibly cheaply made. Production values are on a par with a UK or US TV sitcom of the era. Nevertheless, it is wildly imaginative and executed with plenty of energy and verve. Principally a vehicle for the two titular wrestlers, the movie's acting performances are probably best described as serviceable. Not that the original target audiences would have cared. They were there to see their favourite wrestling heroes go through their paces, which they do, with fights breaking out every time the plot flags, which is pretty often. In truth, the monsters aren't utilised particularly well. They are pretty much deployed as generic wrestling heavies rather than any of them employing their unique characteristics. Cyclops does have an underwater fight with Santo, to be fair. Well, I'm not sure I'd want to sit through another one. Santo appeared in a long series of these movies. I was entertained by Santo and Blue Demon against the monsters. It made an interesting diversion from my usual choice of exploitation viewing.
The night you meet the other you is the first night in the Age of Horror.
Very well. I pleaded with you to let me leave in peace. You refused. Now, look.
I, Monster. Christopher Lee. Peter Cushing and Mike Raven add diabolical chills to the story of a man who made the trip to the other world once too often.
Mr. Blake?
Now for him, Earth is nothing more than a terror stop somewhere between hell and the other world.
What are you waiting for?
I, Monster. Recommended only if your veins can stand the cold torment of evil. Not storybook evil, but the evil you may face this very night. I, Monster. The other you. I, Monster. Rated PG. Parental guidance suggested.
Despite the intriguing title, I, Monster, from 1971, is simply another retelling of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. Another attempt by Amicus to stray into Hammer's territory by producing a full-length gothic feature rather than their usual anthology films. The project yielded indifferent results, despite being a pet project for company co-owner Milton Subotsky. Indeed, Subotsky was arguably the film's biggest problem. His insistence on attempting to film it using an untried 3D process, which supposedly would have allowed audiences to experience stereoscopic effects without having to wear glasses, and according to those involved in production, only Subotsky could see the 3D effect during rushes, everyone else experiencing headaches instead. Anyway, this resulted in much footage having to be cut. Consequently, the finished film runs only 75 minutes, far too short for a feature at a time when most ran at least 90 minutes. Subotsky's adaptation of the source material didn't help much either. Aside from changing the protagonist's names from Jekyll and Hyde to Marlowe and Blake, and adding in some mild Freudian subtext, it's pretty much a straightforward retelling of the Stevenson story. Unlike, say, Hammer's first attempt, 1960's The Two Faces of Dr. Jekyll, or the later 1971 effort, Dr. Jekyll and Sister Hyde, this treatment doesn't attempt any kind of radical reinterpretation of the story and characters. Something badly needed if I, Monster, was to have any chance of distinguishing itself from the plethora of other adaptations. Moreover, some of Subotsky's dialogue is pretty dire, defeating even the likes of Peter Cushing. Nevertheless, the film's failure was, rather unfairly, laid squarely at the feet of first-time director Stephen Weeks. Despite the problems he had to deal with, Weeks does succeed in delivering a reasonably stylish-looking film on a very low budget, bolstered by some decent performances from Christopher Lee as Marlowe stroke Blake and Cushing as Utterson. Their presence alone indicate that Amicus saw this as some kind of prestige production. Celebrated non-acting horror star and DJ Mike Raven also features. Ultimately, a hugely frustrating film. You can't help but feel it a missed opportunity for Lee to give another definitive horror performance, if nothing else. I, Monster does at least have a decent trailer. I must admit that I haven't seen it in a few years. It used to be a late-night regular on British TV, but was put in mind of it by Talking Pictures TV giving it an outing in their Cellar Club feature. Despite its inadequacies, I, Monster is still worth a look, providing a fairly decent, if unsurprising, adaptation of the Stevenson story.
Come in. This is my mechanical invention. It's actually a time machine. The experiments consist in making the chosen subject by decomposing its atoms to be projected in time and space to a previous life. Well, looking at the kind of furniture, she seems to be at the end of the last century.
Indeed. And by her behavior, she seems to be sick. Louisa lived in the same time as a vampire. Count Alucard.
Thank you.
bumped into another one of those Mexican wrestling movies. This one's called The Champions of Justice from 1971. It features Blue Demon and his band of vigilante masked wrestlers riding around on motorcycles and fighting villainous mad scientist The Black Hand and his army of dwarf wrestlers, all to the accompaniment of a jazz soundtrack. They must have been smoking some powerful shit when they made this. A dwarf has just got thrown into a control panel which then exploded. The dwarf wrestlers all dress in red costumes with masks and capes and attack the good guys en masse in order to overwhelm them. Oh, and the Black Hand's master plan seems to have something to do with kidnapping the contestants in a beauty pageant. And one of these contestants is, I think, Blue Demon's goddaughter. As I say, at least that's what I think is going on. Because, you know, it's at times like these when I find myself watching this sort of insanity that I'm tempted to ask myself where my life is going, or indeed how it got here. I keep thinking that I really should make more effort to get back into some kind of paid employment. But, you know, it's February. The weather's bad, it's gloomy, the prospect of getting out of bed early to go out and do all that just doesn't appeal to me right now. Besides, that last job I had ended up being so bloody traumatic that I'm just in no hurry to expose myself to that sort of crap again. Believe me, there's nothing worse than the toxic work environment where you can't trust anybody, nobody has your back, and management most certainly don't have anyone's interests other than their own at heart. So I find myself on my sofa, watching Mexican wrestling films. But it isn't as if my activities these days are entirely passive. I also spend time writing and podcasting about all this pop culture I consume, not to mention continuing to come up with stuff for the sleaze. The trouble is, of course, that all this creative output isn't regarded by wider society as being work, despite the effort that it requires. Certainly nobody seems prepared to pay me for any of it. Yeah. A torrent of spam emails from those guys telling me how I can, with their help, monetize my web presence. Anyway, despite the stuff I'm currently doing apparently being unsaleable, I keep circling back to the idea of some kind of self-employment. That way I have some control over my workplace and who I work with and for. The problem is finding something I can do that other people are actually willing to pay me to do, which is easier said than done. Ah, well. Back to the sofa and those Mexican wrestling movies in the meantime.
Samson and the Vampire Women. Deep in the bowels of the earth live the most savage and vicious of all women. They capture, they drain the blood from human beings to make themselves beautiful in Samson and the Vampire Women.
These two blue marks close together on the victim's neck are what have me puzzled, Inspector. Besides that, we didn't find one drop of blood in the corpse.
Why, you could swear that a vampire murdered the girl.
Hey, now that I think about it, I'll bet those monsters were vampires, Doc.
See Mighty Samson set fire to the vampire's cave in Samson and the Vampire Women.